I am so pleased to introduce to you our guest this morning. Her name is Reverend Runwa Hamami, and I'm so pleased she's here today. Welcome. She is a community minister affiliated with the Mount Diablo Unitarian Church in Walnut Creek. They currently serve as the president of DRUM, Diverse Revolutionary Unitarian Universalist Multicultural Ministries, a national organization for Unitarian Universalist people of color. Beginning in January, which is right around the corner, Reverend Runwa will also serve as the new executive director of the Unitarian Justice Ministry of California. When not working, she enjoys spending time with her spouse and her five four-legged children, cats, and guinea pigs. She enjoys baking and singing. Before I invite her up, I do want to share one more thing with you, is that when you email, a lot of times people will put little poems or saying at the bottom of their email. I really like what you put down, so I wanted to share with you. It emphasizes our love, regular people love, can really change the world. And this is what she has. I know love will save us. The proof is in the stories not broadcast, the poems not published, the truth between the lies, the stories whispered in the dusk of this day.
So we're just around the corner from New Year's Eve. Christmas has just passed, and we had our solstice last week. These are all turning points in our lives where we are often looking forward, where we hope, where we are emerging, and particularly when we think about the solstice, from this time of this nurturing and peaceful nature of the dark, and moving towards anticipation and the coming of the light, of joy, of possibility. These turning points are times when we might act with greater intention and renewed imagination, a clearer sense of mission, of purpose. One of those ways some of us may try to do this around New Year's is with that dreaded word, resolutions. For some, it may be hopeful. It may be a chance to try something again or try something new. Personally, I am terrible at keeping resolutions, so I have made the meta resolution of resolving not to make any resolutions. And whether it's in these turning points in our calendars or our religious lives, or simply a Tuesday in April, we find ourselves always making plans, setting intentions. Why? Why do we make plans? Why do you make plans?
To make progress.
To make progress. And hope?
To be prepared
to accomplish things.
To enjoy.
To enjoy. So what was here? I heard something else here. There was to enjoy.
Hope. Change.
To not forget.
I have one.
Uh-huh.
Goals.
Goals. Yeah. Plans set our goals.
To create.
Yeah. Something to look forward to. And embedded in all of these, and I'm sure there are more, so if you have ones you want to tell me afterwards, please do. I don't want to overlook that. But we make those plans looking forward, to set intentions, and sometimes to sort of try to have some sense of control over what is happening in our lives, to try to have a sense of security, to ensure success when we try to accomplish things. A lot of those reasons we make plans are grounded in hope, in that hope for something new, something different, something that we think can be possible. We even make worst-case scenario plans. Contingencies, with the hope that maybe we can still achieve something. For some of us, we may live with a condition that requires us to make plans as a means of survival, as a means of security. And for some of the justice work I know I've worked on, and I imagine some of you have too, planning is an organizing strategy. And particularly in recent civil disobedience acts at the border, planning is a strategy so that we can make an intentional choice about how we want to be. When we are engaging in legislative advocacy, we plan to make an intentional choice to achieve our goals. In our daily lives, we plan. In our justice actions, we plan. In our resolutions, we plan. How many times have you had plans succeed? I'm judging. Raise your hand if every plan you've ever made has succeeded. How about 75% of them? 50? Less than half? But we still make these plans knowing that they're not going to go according to plan. We even have those idioms and those expressions like, you make plans and God laughs. Or having plan A, B, C, X, Y, Z, all of those plans in case the first 25 don't work. So if we plan knowing that things are likely not going to go according to plan, why do we do it? You gotta start somewhere. Well, there's a couple stories that I think illuminate maybe some of the possible answers to that question, because I'm not going to give you any answers today. Just more questions as a good UU does. One of these stories comes from about 2,000 years ago, and another comes from last month. So who here is familiar with Jesus and the feeding of the thousands, that story in the Christian New Testament? So I like the story because it really shows how Jesus, as an organizer, made plans and adapted them. So this story, one of the first things I love about this story is that it immediately follows a significant loss in Jesus's life. When Jesus is out with some of his primary disciples, they hear a word that one of his dearest friends and followers, John the Baptist, has been executed by the government because of his organizing work. And so Jesus, in the story as it's told in the book of Matthew, goes to a lonely spot in private. But the crowds and the towns around him hear of him leaving to go to this spot, and they follow him. And in his state of grief and loss, in this moment where the plans of his organizing have shifted and his plans to grieve have also been foiled, he sees these crowds, and his heart is moved at the sight of them. And he chooses to heal the sick among them. And in the evening, after seeing and experiencing this grief, this illness of those around him, his lead disciples tell Jesus that they should send the crowds back to the village so that those villagers can get food for themselves, because they don't have enough in their current location. And Jesus says in response, they need not go away. It is for you to give them something to eat. And his disciples respond, we have nothing here except 5 loaves and 2 fishes. Jesus says, bring them to me. He blesses them and he breaks them among his disciples, who then begin to distribute them to the crowd. And the book of Matthew says, everyone was filled with what they had to eat. And they picked up enough of the broken pieces that they were left to fill 12 baskets. I love this story. Because as Jesus experiences this grief, this loss, his life is challenged by this great personal disaster. His heart remains open. It remains open to the suffering of others, to that yearning to be in community. And he practices what I like to think of as transgressive hospitality. He could have sent those followers away. He could have said, there isn't enough here. But he didn't. He doesn't have a plan when he says, bring me that bread and those two fishes. He doesn't have a plan when he distributes it among the disciples. But he has trust in something beyond him, beyond his disciples. He has trust in that gathered community that there will be enough to provide. And in the end, he does get his alone time. As the crowds go, as his disciples leave him to return back to the town, he gets his time to grieve as well. So that's the story from 2,000 years ago. And not all of us are necessarily fed in the same way by stories that come from the Christian New Testament. So I'm going to offer a story that comes from what I will call the queer gospel. It is what I call the LGBTQ loaves and fishes story. This happened to myself and others about a month ago, or a little over a month ago. Last month, I was on a border journey trip with the UU Justice Ministry of California, with members of the Mount Diablo Unitarian Universalist Church. And this border journey is something that the UUJMCA offers about 3 or 4 times a year. They typically have a program they like to follow. Has anyone been on those immersions or those border trips? Well, take a look at it next year. We'll have more. But they have a typical program with specific site visits and partner organizations that they work with to provide an educational and intentional experience for those of us who go on these trips. But from the beginning, our trip in early November was different. From the beginning, before we even crossed the border from San Diego, the organizers stressed the need for all of us to be a little flexible. They had sent out an agenda of planned visits down to the hour, but that was going to have to change. Because our trip to Tijuana was right as the first waves of that highly publicized Central American migrant group was arriving to Tijuana themselves. We were going to be there amidst a lot of change for so many lives. So many of those partners and those sites that are typically part of the UUJMCA's programming were involved in supporting this first wave and the continuing waves of these migrants. So our schedule shifted non-stop. And on the second day we were in Tijuana, we were actually invited to the location where the LGBT contingent was staying. There was a group of LGBTQ migrants that had to break off for their own safety. And they were staying above a cafe run by Food Not Bombs. And there we met organizers from Al Otro Lado, Another Love, who were working with a legal team of volunteers on supporting this contingent, as well as many of the unaccompanied children that were a part of this caravan. And when I went up to one of the leaders in my role with DROM and with the UUA, and I said, how can we as a faith provide greater and intentional support? She looked at me and she said, can you do some weddings? Yeah, that was sort of my reaction of what? Okay, tell me a little bit more. That was a little unexpected. And then it got even more curious when she said they wanted them that day. So we talked out the details. We talked out the why. We knew that these could not be legal weddings because none of us there were licensed to perform weddings and marriages in Mexico, but we could absolutely hold religious ceremonies and provide them with religious certificates. And the hope, the plan, was that those who were able to participate in these ceremonies would have some concrete proof that they were married, at least in the eyes of love or of God, in the eyes of a church, and that that could be enough for them to stay together when they are inevitably placed in detention centers as they seek asylum. So we had a meeting with about five couples on the roof of this Airbnb who were thrilled that they were going to have a wedding. And then when they realized it was happening that night, two couples dissolved into tears of joy. Meanwhile, the rest of us were breathing deeply, trying to figure out how this was going to work. So this was at 1 p.m., this meeting where we talked briefly with them about what it is they would like to have in their wedding and what we need to pull together in that time. And in 3 hours, we were going to have a wedding for these five couples. So the reason I call this a queer loaves and fishes story is because in those 3 hours, this cafe with this empty Airbnb now filled with LGBTQ migrants, asylum seekers, they managed to put together this magnificent rainbow altar complete with rainbow carnations. They had several cakes. They had confetti poppers. The couples all were dressed to the nines for their wedding. We had managed to find rings for each couple that fit. We had a Spanish language ceremony provided by the Reverend Tanya Marquez, who serves in San Diego. We had a Spanish language marriage certificate from the Church of the Larger Fellowship and their blessing to use it. And we had two witnesses for each of those certificates. And it turns out, four officiants. And somehow, in the last 10 or 15 minutes before the ceremony, two other couples decided that they wanted to get married. And somehow we were able to find rings that fit and get more certificates to make sure they could participate. We didn't plan for that day at all. None of us planned to go to a wedding that day. None of us planned to officiate a wedding that day. Those couples definitely hadn't planned to get married that day. But because of our flexibility together, because of our willingness to embrace that maybe the plans don't have to stick exactly, we were able to change and transform and to let a miracle happen, to be part of creating that miracle together. We had the gratitude to just be present in that situation. We knew that if we were to open ourselves, something sacred could enter in ways that we would not have foreseen. We didn't foresee when we first registered for this trip months before. And we allowed for possibilities, a new approach. And that LGBT contingent, that LGBTQ contingent also had their own plans. These migrants, these asylum seekers, they are constantly facing precarious situations, circumstances that are unsafe and unjust and unpredictable. So as much as they can make plans, they have to be flexible and constantly changing just so that they can stay alive. And yet, when we walked into that cafe and we saw that community, when that community pulled together this amazing celebration, they created this presence of resilience and love. They themselves practiced that transgressive hospitality because one of those couples traveling with the caravan was actually a heterosexual couple who had a young child and another on the way. And while they could have said no, this is for LGBTQ asylum seekers, they welcomed this family as one of their own. This contingent, their plans had to constantly shift, moving from location to location to stay hidden and safe. They chose that night for the weddings because they could be as loud and celebratory and public as possible. And they committed to making that plan to pack up and move to a new safe location right after. Amidst constant change, they co-created among themselves in community and with others present to their struggle that day, something that no plans could have predicted. With all of that uncertainty, with all of that unplanned magic, we created something beautiful together. But there was still a plan that worked. That plan was love. That really was part of our goal as a contingent, as our small group of journeyers going on this trip, was to love by bearing witness, by being present, by learning, and by bringing back what we have learned to this side of the border, to open hearts and minds. And that LGBTQ contingent had a plan, not just to survive, but to thrive, to support one another, to grow stronger with each other, and to maybe have a better life. And in celebrating that night, in making the decision to have this incredible ceremony, they moved closer to that as well. None of us planned to go to a wedding that day. But in some ways, we met another plan. So for us, what does that mean in our everyday lives? What happens when our best laid plans go awry, or when we have no idea what to plan? Some of these can be manageable enough. You know, if we don't have children for the service that day, we ask for the young of heart to come and play with us. And y'all, I got my nice little cardio with that today, so thank you. Some of them are a little bit more stressful. Who's missed a flight and had no idea how you were going to get home or to where you needed to go? That's a little stressful, right? And some are utterly devastating. Being diagnosed with a debilitating illness, eviction from your home, the death of a loved one, the loss of a job. What happens when our best laid plans don't just go awry, but sometimes pull the very ground from beneath us? So that safety, that hope, that security, that success, that progress that they were there for, no longer feels within our control. Our call to worship this morning came from Adrienne Marie Brown's Emergent Strategy, a book that I highly recommend for folks interested in learning how to engage with what is and be present to our capacity to love. And in it, she describes emergence as being beyond what the sum of its parts could even imagine. And she says that some of those principles of emergent strategy is to remember change is constant, to trust the people, to engage in less prep and more presence. And she reminds us that change is definitely going to happen no matter what. No matter what we plan or expect or hope or set in place, we will adapt to that change or we will become irrelevant. She describes herself as a Virgo, somebody who doesn't like it when plans don't go as intended, and says that I have been working on listening for the opportunity. Often this means I have to have a longer view, that time is so good, so consistently illuminating. With time, the apparent crisis becomes a massive blessing. That LGBTQ contingent was in a massive crisis. And yet, there was an opportunity that they listened for and that we, as our privileged community going into that situation without a plan, also listened for an opportunity, and we created something. When our plans go awry, it's not something that we have to do alone. It's not something that disconnects us. When our plans go awry, those opportunities still exist. There are ways that we can reach out to others, to trust the people, as Adrienne Mary Brown says, to let the miracle in. In those moments when we have meticulously laid out plans or we come there with no clue what's going to happen next, we can let each other in. We can be that miracle for each other, co-creating something bigger than the sum of our parts. Our best laid plans don't always come to fruition. Our lives have been and will always include challenges, plot twists, and uncertainty. And in those moments when control feels elusive and our next steps are unclear, together we can find a way to make a miracle happen. Together, we can achieve a greater plan beyond what we initially thought possible.